Rule one in live radio, if there is a guitar in the studio, use it. In Asia, a battle with nature, a race against time. In the U.S., an election endgame that may be for real this time. Lebanese power games, gasoline prices on the rise. And candidate John McCain was on Saturday Night Live. Rule number two in live radio, oh, don't overdo it. The weekend's over. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, May 19th. We do have a live guitarist in the studio. More about our friend Jack the Martini Cowboy Grace in a moment. Today, intervention is the buzzword in cyclone ravaged Myanmar, but how? More primaries this week, but do they matter? We look at the secret struggle of gays in the Muslim world, and country music has its big awards night. That and all the news. China, 1 week later. For 3 minutes today, the country stood still and car horns wailed to commemorate the tens of thousands of people killed in a massive earthquake last week. It's killed more than 50,000 people with a $9.5 billion loss to business. Thousands of people are still missing. But in a hopeful note, China's news agency says two women were rescued alive today from the rubble. Myanmar's junta has allowed the UN to tour the cyclone devastation in the country, but not international aid workers. John Holmes, the UN's chief humanitarian officer, spent time in the area where hunger, disease, and homelessness are adding to the tragedy of at least 78,000 deaths. Officials say 56,000 people are missing. More on the standoff coming up.
What's another 17 cents at these prices? It's another record. The average price of a gallon of self-serve regular gasoline has hit $3.79 a gallon. According to the increasingly grim Lundberg survey, two places have already gone above $4 per gallon, Chicago and Long Island. In another internet posting, Osama bin Laden is railing against Arab leaders for not coming together to fight Israel. The tape was posted yesterday on a site often used by al-Qaeda. It's the second bin Laden recording released this week.
Barack Obama may not yet be the Democratic nominee, but he's looking like a rock star in Oregon. An estimated 75,000 people attended a Riverside rally in Portland yesterday. He's expected to win big there in tomorrow's primary. Hillary Clinton, meanwhile, was campaigning in Kentucky, where she's expected to win big this week.
And hit it, Jack. At the 43rd Annual Academy of Country Music Awards in Las Vegas, it was Kenny Chesney taking home the top award for Entertainer of the Year. Taylor Swift won for Best New Female Vocalist. Brad Paisley won Top Male Vocalist. And Sugarland Stay won Best Song of the Year. Jack, don't overdo it, okay, buddy? Jack Grace is with us today, and we'll review the awards later in the show. The Dow begins at 12,986. The S&P stands at 14,25. And we have a question.
We do. Today we're talking about contradictions, and we want to know, what kind of contradictions do you have? Do you have in your life
big contradictions, ones, like small big ones? Moral, lapsed Catholic kind of contradictions, or are they small, sort of I drive the SUV but I tell my kids to turn off the lights kind of contradictions?
Right. Or maybe you're a dieter who loves donuts and just can't give those up.
Tell us.
Two usually don't go well together.
877-8 my take. You can call us or email at mytake@thetakeaway.org. I don't want you overdoing it this hour, Jack. Okay? No overdoing it.
I'll try that.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Tomorrow, Kentucky and Oregon voters finally get their chance to go to the polls as the Democratic primary winds down. John, there's a total of 103 pledged delegates and 21 superdelegates at stake. Clinton's been stumping hard in Kentucky, where she leads the polls by as much as 30%. Obama's barely been there. In Oregon, a record 80,000 cheering people showed up to see Obama, where he has a significant lead. Both states are expected to get healthy returns, but not the record turnouts we've seen in other states. Joining us now is Rick Howlett, the news director from Louisville's public radio station, WFPL, and from Oregon, President Jim Moore, a political analyst for Oregon, Professor Jim Moore, a political analyst for Oregon Public Broadcasting from Pacific University. Let's start with you, Rick. You say voters in Kentucky have never gotten so much attention, that journalists have been scrambling to cover all of these events, but there have been mostly Clinton events where you say she's been hitting all the right notes, jobs, economy, health care. Does that explain why she's up 30% in the polls?
Absolutely. She's been here a lot. And she's campaigning, you know, the old adage, campaign like you're 20 points behind. That's exactly what she's been doing.
Now, Kentucky is a Democratic state, but went for Bush, 60% of the voters did anyhow, in 2004. You see any shift? Has Clinton's time been well spent there for the Democratic Party?
I think so. This has been great for Kentucky, as it's really elevated the conversation here. A lot more people talking about the core issues, and I think it has been beneficial for Kentucky in that way. I'm not sure so much about the Democratic Party itself, but It has more people engaged in the conversation about the issues.
And Professor Moore, that's certainly been an ongoing theme in this election year, engagement. We've seen record turnouts in many places. And Oregon looks like Obama country, talking about records. Those pictures of those 80,000 people watching him were pretty incredible. Whereas you haven't seen Clinton as much, and Obama certainly raised a whole lot more money than she has. What's the draw for Obama there in Oregon?
Well, I think the draw is kind of twofold. First of all, there's just that rock star quality that you talked about briefly. Oregon is caught up in it. This is the first time in 40 years that our primary has meant anything, because we always have our primary so late. So that is getting people going. The fact that he's been here hitting college campuses and things like that gets people going. But the second thing is he's really connecting with people on Oregon issues. Usually when candidates come through Oregon, they give their standard stump speech and they throw in the fact that they can pronounce the name of a river or something, or even say Oregon instead of Oregon.
Willamette River.
Exactly.
Willamette. There you go.
You've got it.
Professor Moore, I mean, it sounds like Oregon is expressing some of its Wayne Morse kind of Hatfield oppositional sort of leftism. I mean, Obama is definitely a way for Oregon to say, hey, we were right, in the sense that they're doing it and are part of the mainstream this time around.
Yeah, absolutely. You've got a lot of that going on. And it'll be really interesting to see what happens in the fall. You know, the registration among Democrats has soared up to levels that we usually see with a general election, for instance, in 2004 when John Kerry registered a lot of voters. But just among Democrats, people have been going from registered as independents to Democrats, and a few thousand Republicans have switched over to Democrats. And so we're looking for a fall where the Democrats may have a sizable majority for the first time in forever in Oregon.
Rick, let me ask you one quick question. Has there been the same sense of Hillary or nobody in Kentucky as we seem to have seen in the exit polling from neighboring West Virginia last week? The idea that it's all about Hillary and we're not interested in Barack Obama if he makes it to the nomination.
That's the way it looks at this point. The last poll that I've seen pitting McCain against Obama gives McCain like a 30-point advantage. Now, in the past couple of weeks, Obama has kind of ratcheted up his grassroots organization here. He has about 16 campaign offices open around the state. Michelle Obama will be here in Louisville and a couple other stops today. So, I mean, there's still time, but at this point, it's like you said, it's been Hillary or nobody.
And, Rick, do you think that is because voters there just are unfamiliar with Barack Obama, or is it, as you mentioned earlier, that there's this long-term relationship with the Clintons?
I think it's a little bit of both. Obama really hasn't established himself here yet, and they're very familiar. Kentuckians are very familiar with the Clintons, of course. Bill Clinton carried the state in 92 and 96, so they're quite familiar with the Clintons and their record.
Rick Howlett from Louisville, Jim Moore from Oregon, thank you both. Rick Howlett is news director at Louisville's public radio station, WFPL. Jim Moore is a political analyst at Pacific University for Oregon Public Broadcasting.
Well, the latest bit of conventional wisdom to be demolished by this race is that Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama battling it out in the primary race was going to have some positive benefit for the Republicans. It has not, certainly in the money race. John McCain campaign has been falling behind. Last month, he collected $18 million, way below what Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton have been netting. Barack Obama getting $40 million each month this year. Michael Luo from The New York Times has been following McCain's campaign, the money raising and other developments. He's literally on the McCain plane right now. Michael, what are McCain's strategies for trying to keep up financially with the Democrats?
Well, McCain doesn't have his main lacking is that he doesn't have this internet-powered financial operation that Obama really has mastered and Clinton has gotten better at. And so he really is depending on the high-dollar donations. And so as he's as the Democratic nomination continues to drag on, he's just been doing a fundraising event after fundraising event. And a big thing for him is they have this joint committee that is able to raise money for his campaign as well as the Republican National Committee and a couple of other state Republican committees. And that allows him, some big donors to write checks as large as $70,000, that will be divvied up amongst each of these different entities, depending on their contribution limits. And
but, Michael, that's going to force John McCain to rely on President Bush for financial support, which may be strategically a tough choice going to November.
Yeah, he's been distancing himself from Bush on the stump, but Bush is doing a couple of events for him. They're doing a joint event in Phoenix next week, and they're doing Bush by himself is doing an event in Salt Lake City that's actually with Mitt Romney, two events actually in Utah next week too. And so, yeah, Bush remains a great fundraiser for the Republican Party, even if its popularity nationwide has fallen.
I mean, there is something funny about even this conversation, which is here you are talking about two candidates, Obama and McCain, who have pledged in the past to adhere to public financing rules, but it doesn't appear that either one of them is likely to honor that at this point.
No, actually, McCain will be opting for public financing for the general election. That's the that's $84 million that he'll be able to get from the Treasury after the convention. But it's Obama is the one who is backing away from that pledge he made. He indicated last year that if the Republican nominee took public finance, he would as well. But, you know, it appears increasingly unlikely that he's going to do that. I mean, he just can't sheath this powerful sword that he has, this fundraising machine that he has. And he's trying to argue that it's his own version of public financing.
Right, it's public because there's millions of people who are contributing to him, even in small contributions. Michael Luo, that's great. Certainly following the money is more interesting in this campaign than in campaigns past. Michael Luo of The New York Times covering the McCain campaign. And if you listen to the pundit shows over the weekend, see if you can guess what the pundit word of the week was.
As the Democrats close ranks, Republicans hunker down.
The Republican brand is in the trash can.
The Republican brand is badly damaged.
And the Republican Party is busy dying. The worst political environment for Republicans since Watergate.
Look, this is a party that is an airplane flying towards a mountain in the dark.
I mean, you have trash cans, you have busy dying, you have mountains, you have planes crashing into mountains.
Republican brand is in trouble. Financially, as Michael Luo was saying, that is true. But I guess as one way of trying to resurrect that brand, we heard John McCain on Saturday Night Live over the weekend.
I'd urge Democrats not to get caught up in the idea that the candidate has to be decided by the time the convention ends. I've been to a lot of conventions, and they're a lot of fun. But when they end, there's always that empty feeling of, oh, well, we picked a nominee. I guess the party's over. Imagine the excitement of leaving the convention and still not knowing who the nominee was. That would be crazy. Crazy exciting.
A tongue-in-cheek cry for help from the Democrats, from John McCain on Saturday Night Live.
So you describe it.
It's a serious point, though. The negatives have not gone down for the Republicans, even as the sort of battle between Obama and Hillary Clinton has
taken
place.
Yeah, they haven't been able to capitalize. There's no question. Yeah. And we'll certainly be talking a whole lot more about that in the days and weeks in this very long campaign.
Jack Gray, should the Republicans release a new album?
Yes, they should, and they should entitled maybe Sings Ronald Reagan's Greatest Hits.
Ronald Reagan's Greatest Hits. Maybe we'll see that at the convention. Thank you very much, Jack Grace.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. You may have missed it with all the other news, but when the shooting stopped last week in Lebanon between Sunni supporters and Hezbollah, people of Lebanon had witnessed the worst internal fighting since the 15-year civil war in Lebanon that ended in 1990. 67 people dead, 200 people wounded, and the political roadmap of Lebanon was completely remade. Hezbollah has proved that it's far stronger than any other military force in the land. And that's an enormously significant story for the entire region. The two sides in Lebanon met in Qatar over the weekend for talks about the country's 18-month political crisis. Jim Muir from the BBC has been covering the latest from Beirut and noting a growing feeling of hopelessness on the ground. Jim, the question really is, where do we go from here?
Well, where we go from here is Qatar in the Gulf. That's where all the leaders have gone, and that's where they are having their heads banged together by the leaders of that Gulf emirate, who are trying to persuade them to shelve their differences enough to get this country back on its feet. Politics here has been paralyzed for the last 18 months, during which time Hezbollah and its allies, who include some Christians, have been physically besieging the government building in downtown Beirut with a kind of tented encampment, and that kind of standoff symbolizes the paralysis that has set in with the deadlock between the Syrian and Iranian-backed opposition headed by Hezbollah and the government side, which is pretty much supported by the Americans and the West and by conservative Arab states such as Egypt and Saudi Arabia. So where do we go from here? As I say, they're having their heads banged together. In theory, they've just got two major issues to sort out or to agree on. One is the composition of a national unity government. And when I say composition, we're talking about the exact breakdown of who gets how many seats in it, with Hezbollah and its allies looking for what they call paralyzing third. In other words, enough votes to have veto power on government decision-making.
And Jim,
we
should remind people that Lebanon's government has been held together by a flimsy sort of formula that dates back to the 1940s. And I'm wondering if that is completely out the window with these latest developments.
Not at the moment. No, they're still committed to that. As you know, back in 1989, there was a kind of revision of the constitution at Taif. Again, the Lebanese leaders being moved out to a kind of neutral location, Taif in Saudi Arabia, where they actually got locked away for 4 weeks before they came up with an agreement. That was more complicated because they were revising the entire constitution. But the basic and changing the balance between Christian and Muslim representation to 50-50 rather than 60-40 in favor of the Christians, which had become demographically outmoded. So no, the basic formula is still there. Nobody's saying we should scrap that. What's happened, though, on the ground is that Hezbollah proved what we all knew, which is that it is the strongest power in the land, and that includes the Lebanese army.
Jim, was this provoked by the government and the U.S.-backed allies by actually forcing the hand of Hezbollah with a relatively superficial kind of investigation into something going on at the airport 2 weeks ago?
Those decisions taken by the government, they had a very long session in the middle of the night, which is pretty unusual, and they came out with these two decisions, one to declare illegal Hezbollah's private landline phone network, internal phone, operational phone network, and secondly, to shift the head of security at Beirut Airport, who'd been accused of being close to Hezbollah and ignoring the fact that Hezbollah had apparently, according to the other side, set up a kind of spy camera looking onto the main runway so they could monitor the movements of VIPs and so on. So, yeah, that decision by the government was seen as very provocative. It wasn't decisions that they could actually do anything about, especially communications network, but Hassan Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah, took that as a declaration of war by the government, and that's why he unleashed this onslaught by his fighters and his allies into West Beirut and eventually into the mountains,
Jim,
as
that,
well.
Jim, that's what made it so perplexing, is why they would take this action that would not surprisingly be taken as confrontational. But let me ask you about this. You describe the situation there today, now, following that violence, as unnervingly calm, but you're saying that a lot of people are very anxious, and that some people are so fed up that they're actually leaving and going to Canada. They just can't see a way out of this crisis. What does that say about moving forward and reconciling all of these contradictions and complex issues?
Well, the reason that a lot of people, or quite some people, are thinking about leaving, and they have been leaving in the background in droves for the last couple of years, is that this latest episode brought home to them the fact that this country is not stable, and that there are elements in the region as well. It's not just the internal situation of Lebanon. It's also the fact you've got Israel on the border, you've got Hezbollah backed by Iran and Syria, getting stronger and stronger in Lebanon itself. They just can't see that patching things up in Qatar or wherever, patching up some deal to get over the immediate crisis, is going to provide long-term stability. So people with kids and so on who want to see a future are seriously thinking of getting out, and some I know have actually taken that decision in the last few days and will be implementing it in the coming few days, changing their lives, because they simply cannot see this country ever being stable enough for them to plan for their children's future and their children's children's future.
Jim Muir of the BBC, thank you very much. Jim Muir reporting from Beirut, where, as a result of fighting last week, the Shiite Iranian-backed Hezbollah holds the balance of power in Lebanon for the first time. And that's something that they're going to definitely have to resolve in Qatar when they finish their talks.
We'll see what happens.
Now headlines from Femi Okeh.
Hello there. It is 28 minutes past the hour, and making news around the world. A U.S. soldier is removed from Iraq for using the Quran as target practice. President Bush is back in Washington after his trip to the Middle East. And China is observing 3 days of mourning for the victims of last week's earthquake. China is also counting the costs of the earthquake today, and not just when it comes to lives. According to the government, companies in the Sichuan province suffered $9.5 billion worth of damage in the May the 12th quake. In Myanmar, the military government has given permission to the UN's humanitarian chief to take a brief tour of areas hit hardest by tropical cyclone Nargis. Earlier today, state-run Burmese television accused the international journalists of spreading lies. Here's a clip from that broadcast.
Some foreign news agencies broadcast false information, and thus some international and regional organizations are assuming that the government has been rejecting and deterring aids from strong victims.
The Burmese state announcer also said the people of Myanmar are accepting donations in cash and kind for its storm victims. The UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is also scheduled to visit Myanmar on Wednesday. And finally, a leading commander of the FARC rebels in Colombia has surrendered to the authorities. Nelly Avila Moreña was blamed by the authorities for a string of murders, abductions and for extortion. Her surrender is seen as a triumph for President Álvaro Uribe, who put a reward of more than $800,000 on her head. And that's a look at your international headlines.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, now featuring Mandy and Lester, a short film about a girl who loses two boxes of Scout cookies, a boy who finds those cookies, and who finds that returning them isn't going to be as simple as it seems. Available at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. It's Monday, May 19th, and today we're asking you about contradictions in your life. Some of them may be big, like, say, religion. Some of them might be small, say, diet or clothes, for example.
What's your contradiction, Jay?
I like to eat, and I also like to sleep. I like to feel good, but I like bad food.
We want you to send us your answers at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Take a listen to what one of you had to say to us.
My name is Muaz Abdul Shakur. I'm in Baltimore, Maryland. My contradiction is being married to a Christian. I'm a Muslim American married to a Christian. In addition to that, is that my career is in the defense industry, providing weapons to be used for in committing war against Muslims in other parts of the world.
Wow!
Wow, those are very serious.
Very serious take on
very
some serious contradictions.
And our subject today, or our next interview, I should say, also is addressing some very serious contradiction. Pervez Sharma has taken on a subject that is quite taboo in Islam, and that's homosexuality. His documentary, shot in 12 countries in the Muslim world, was so controversial that in many places, he said, he had to shoot in secret over the 6 years that he was putting this film together. It is an extraordinary look into the lives of gay and lesbian Muslims, exploring the complexities of those who identify closely with a religion that is not always tolerant towards their sexuality. Pervez, can you tell us about the people in your film?
I think the people in the film are very remarkable individuals, and they are really at the heart of the battle that is happening right now across the world, which is a battle for the soul of Islam. These are people, like myself, who are coming out as Muslims and saying that they have a right to be as Muslim as anybody else.
And there's such a strong feeling, and you show this in your film, that for those who do that, that they deserve to die. Let's take a quick listen to a bit of your film.
Homosexuality is a crime and is punishable in Islam by death.
I guess what was never taught to us when we were growing up is that Allah is also the Allah of love. We always had to fear God. We never were taught about the love of God.
Do you commit and bring that obscene and lewd action where a male fulfills his desire with a male?
There was a lot of honesty in that film, both from the side of religious leaders in Islam, but also from gay and lesbians that you met all over the world. Can you tell us about some of those people and the kinds of struggles that they face, many of them just avoiding death by just such a small margin?
Right. It's a very complex picture in the film. I mean, in the film, you have the gentleman who was just speaking right now, who's a very respected imam in South Africa, in confrontation with an openly gay imam, Mohsin Hendricks, who is really coming out in the film. He's a father of three children. He lived his life with immense contradiction. He went to Pakistan, studied Islamic law, got married to a woman, had three children, got divorced, and was exiled from his community. There are other people in the film who have lived with that contradiction in very intense ways. Now, in some cases, the contradiction is intensely personal. And I think this is a contradiction that is not just unique to Islam. A lot of practicing Christians, especially in this country right now, you know, with gay marriage being such an issue, have felt that.
I mean, we should point out that all religions have struggled with these moral issues. What is unique about Islam's approach to this struggle and the way it's played out in your film? And one of the great things about this film is you had amazing access to people who really let you into a private world that is not often seen.
I did have amazing access, and I think one of the reasons for that was that this was a very Muslim lens, and I was approaching this as a Muslim filmmaker, as a gay Muslim filmmaker, if you will. So I built very strong personal relationships with each one of these individuals, and you see that in the film. That's the honesty that you talk about. What was really important was that I was trying very, very hard in this time of intense Islamophobia to also present a responsible debate, if you will, because it's very easy right now to criticize Islam. And I did not, as a Muslim filmmaker, want to get into that. What I wanted to show was that these people continue to be religious, practicing Muslims, in spite of the condemnation that they face.
I want to get to that criticism in a second, but first let's talk about the young men that you followed in Egypt who actually went to jail, who were lashed viciously, and who were desperately seeking asylum.
Well, we're talking about the Iranian men. I filmed them as they were leaving Iran and ended up in Turkey, and they were desperately seeking asylum in Canada. all four of them made it to Canada. Of course, post September 11th, it's a very difficult freedom that you have as a Muslim refugee, especially if one of you, if your first name is Muhammad, doesn't really help.
But they left because they feared for their lives.
They did. And, you know, it's really interesting. I mean, last year when President Ahmadinejad made those comments at Columbia University.
There's no such thing as homosexuals, right?
He said. Right, but he was misquoted because he said there are no, there's no such thing as homosexuals like you have in the West.
I see.
And if he actually said that, which is what I believe he did, he was right because Iran is a completely different picture, and you certainly don't have gay neighborhoods in Iran or gay bars or the cultures that we're used to in the West. But there's also Mazen in the film, the Egyptian refugee.
Okay, yeah, sorry, and, I got the two of them confused.
And Mazen spent an entire year in an Egyptian prison. Hosni Mubarak's government in 2001 actually carried out a pogrom against gay men. A lot of political observers in Egypt at that time saw it as an effort to appease the Muslim Brotherhood. Because you have to remember, this is a government that is traditionally un-Islamic, and they wanted to take up an issue of morality and say that they were protecting public morality. So they picked on the issue of homosexuality, as a result of which this man, in his early 20s, spent a year in prison being tortured and raped. And you see
and,
that in
and
the
there,
film.
And there are actually pictures of that. Can we just take a quick listen to a bit, another bit of your film, and then a quick question of the criticism you've gotten?
I wish there was a verse in the Quran that said, please do not discriminate against homosexuality.
The only difference among the jurists is how the person should be killed. That's the only difference.
It's a dilemma. They don't know how to deal with it.
Pervez Sharma, a dilemma. Very, very quickly, because we're just about out of time, but you've certainly been criticized on many levels, but particularly about what you've mentioned is this ongoing dialogue about what Islam is, that you are somehow making everything worse as there's so much attention being paid to terrorism linked to Islam.
Very simply, I mean, this film is at the forefront of that battle which is going on for the soul of Islam right now. There are progressive Muslims out there, people we are not hearing from in the mainstream media. There are people who are actually taking up difficult discussions that we need to have as Muslims.
Pervez Sharma, his film A Jihad for Love comes out on Wednesday. Many thanks.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
All of country music was in Vegas last night for the 43rd Annual Academy of Country Music Awards. And it was some show if you watched it on television. I imagine even more extreme if you were in Vegas. Joining us is Jack Grace, the Martini Cowboy, our friend who's been accompanying us all hour. Jack, first of all, the big winners.
Yes, it was quite a night. There were many awards given and lots of cheese was served.
Chesney.
That's right.
Kenny Chesney won for Entertainment of the Year. That was
Yes, he did. That was the one that where they actually voted, the audience voted for the first time ever during the award show. So that, and yet the predicted winner still won, which was interesting.
Fans, not the Academy.
No, but it's fascinating. That was very American Idol-ish.
Yeah. And that's, I guess he even referred to that in his acceptance.
Yeah. And then the Song of the Year was actually an interesting one where, because Sugarland won with the song Stay, and that was actually a song with no drums, and it was acoustic, so that was a surprise for the way the country music industry works as of right now.
No backbeat, no high production value.
No slamming rock and roll drums.
And there was a very emotional moment, I suppose. Well, for country heavies, for people who are sort of mainstream country, the image of George Strait and Kenny Chesney singing together certainly was memorable. Here it is.
Absolutely.
She's mad. Some lad drove off and didn't pay for his gas, and he wanted a lad around the clock hanging.
The old guard and the new.
Yeah, and you know, I think it was kind of interesting that they actually have pretty similar voices. They kind of sound the same to me.
Speaking of conformity, this was the largest aggregation of black shirts, black cowboy hats, and ties that I've ever seen in my life.
You noticed, yeah. Yeah. Well, of the era of, you know, then Garth Brooks came in a little later and still showed one of his not-so-pretty shirts.
And there were some touching moments. I mean, you had the young female artist, Taylor Swift, giving a really memorable thanks to her mom. Let's listen.
There are so many people that deserve to be thanked for this, but I'm just going to thank one. And that's the person that used to love to go to lunch with her friends and cook dinner for her family and sleep in her bed every night. And she gave that all away and left it all behind to go on the road with her 16-year-old daughter. And then she was sleeping.
Taylor Swift won for Best New Female Vocalist, and she had the most bizarre performance, it seemed to me, where she ended up underneath a waterfall.
Yeah, and started so pared down in a little hooded sweatshirt with just an acoustic guitar. We thought we were going to see the real Taylor Swift.
The production, you know, wardrobe disorder. I mean, this is one of the features of the show. I mean, the production is over the top.
It's over the top, and what I notice is that they're really borrowing so much from rock and roll production. We had pyrotechnics. We had all these things, but what's lacking from rock and roll is the anger and the rebellion.
But here's a question. Yeah. Was that a function of it being in Las Vegas, or is this a function of Country Music Awards evolving in a way to capture larger audiences?
They made some note somewhere where they said something about how country music is can always be a little louder in Vegas, but no, that's just the regular production. That's business as usual.
Jason Alexander was there. Do we have time to hear Jason Alexander do an amazing joke?
You know, a lot of the rumors about the country music people, I want to tell you, are not true. First of all, there is the rumor that they're all just sort of categorically people of faith, very religious people. And I'm here to tell you, that's not necessarily true. I flew in late last night just so I could attend services this morning, and I did not see one of you people in synagogue anywhere.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Monday, May 19th, and time for some headlines. Femi Okay's here.
Hi there, Dora. 12 minutes to the hour. Hearings begin today to decide the fate of 464 children removed from a polygamist ranch in Texas last month. The state faces the tough job of determining what parents must do to regain custody of their children. DNA tests are expected this week. Officials hope the tests will clarify thorny relationships. As China mourns at least 34,000 killed in an earthquake a week ago, the official Chinese news agency reports that more than 200 relief workers have been buried by mudslides over the last 3 days in the disaster area. A Chinese official confirms there have been some deaths. One of the best-selling videos right now in Myanmar is full of death and destruction, but it isn't a Hollywood production. People are buying up black market videos of the cyclone devastation to get a better picture of the disaster in a country where military rulers tightly control news coverage. And now some sports news. In hockey news, the Pittsburgh Penguins shut out the Philadelphia Flyers 6-0 on Sunday to clinch their first trip to the Stanley Cup final since 1992, I should say. The Penguins await the winner of tonight's contest between the Detroit Red Wings and the Dallas Stars. And in horse racing, Big Brown ran away with this year's Preakness, taking the race by more than 5 lengths. Big Brown's trainer, Rick Dertra, won't win any prizes for modesty.
I was not surprised that he went so easy because I know we have a really good horse and I know that he was running in a race where they didn't have good horses running.
Next up, Big Brown heads to the Belmont and possibly a Triple Crown on June the 7th. And finally, Indy is back and he's back in Cannes.
This ain't going to be easy. Not as easy as it used to be.
65-year-old Harrison Ford is one of Hollywood's oldest action stars, but the crowds at the Cannes Film Festival didn't seem to care. And if you want to see how Ford plays Indy after a 19-year hiatus, Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of Crystal Skull opens in the US May the 22nd.
We'll have more about that later in the week, I'm sure. Thank you very much, Femi.
You're welcome.
And now diplomatic sources in Myanmar say the military government has invited representatives of several countries to visit the cyclone-hit area 2 weeks after a devastating cyclone. They say the invitation follows meetings by representatives of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations who are trying to persuade Myanmar's government to allow relief workers access to an estimated 2.5 million people at risk. An estimated 78,000 are dead. The diplomatic sources did not say which countries received invitations. But the standoff over aid in Myanmar has put on the table the question of what is to be done. Should an intervention over the heads of the Myanmar government get aid distributed to the civilian population at risk, or should negotiations continue? Joining us now is former ambassador, U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, John Bolton. Mr. Bolton, thank you for joining us.
Glad to be here.
You are certainly a harsh critic of the United Nations. I'm wondering if the U.N. is being tested now, and do you have any reason to believe that the UN can coordinate some sort of intervention to get aid into Myanmar?
Well, certainly the reaction has been very slow, although, as you were saying, the government of Burma hasn't done anything to help. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon will be going there this week. But once again, I think the UN agencies, the World Food Program and others, sat back for days waiting for the government of Burma to do something and didn't apply the kind of pressure perhaps they could have very early on. So the problem now, 2 weeks since the cyclone, is the after effects that could have been mitigated had the relief agencies gotten in earlier.
What are the protocols for the United Nations to intervene in a situation like that? Don't they have to wait to be invited? And what are the precedents for going in uninvited in a situation as dire as this?
Well, there really aren't any precedents like that. And, you know, we do have experience when you try and put in humanitarian relief efforts without having a system on the ground. Often you're just giving the relief supplies to thugs or to the government to distribute, in this case, to their own military. I think what should have been done is that the heads of the UN agency should have been in the media earlier and doing more to pressure the government of Burma. That I don't think they were doing. But I do think the principal responsibility here lies with the military junta in Burma.
Mr. Ambassador, when you say that they could have done more, what do you think could have been done? Or more importantly, what do you think can be done now? I mean, one of the things that we heard from some of the World Food Program folks last week is that, for example, it was on his understanding that the General Secretary's phone calls were not even being returned from the military junta.
Right. I think this is a probably a demonstration that the junta itself was badly damaged by this cyclone. But the main tactic that I think should have been used was more international attention and more effort to get through. Just because the phone doesn't work doesn't mean that you just sit there and do nothing. And I think this is precious time was lost. So I think really there's fault on both sides, the junta and the UN agencies.
Well, the alternative to UN intervention, of course, is unilateral intervention on the part of one of the larger powers. And Gordon Brown over the weekend expressed reluctance for Great Britain to go in. Do you have any suspicion that the United States has any sort of contingency to deliver aid above and over the heads of the Myanmar government?
Well, I think that's a very risky proposition for the United States or anybody else, which is why, although people talk about it, it doesn't actually happen. You know, to distribute the food, it's not just a question of offloading it at docks. You have to have a distribution network. You have to have some internal order. And I think what we can see is that the government of Burma was devastated by this and just simply wasn't able to respond. On the other hand, if they had said, look, we are devastated. You need to come in and help. I have no doubt the UN agencies, non-governmental organizations would have done that. But that also did not happen.
But the question is, what's the tipping point and who will constitute the force that really brings new, a whole new approach to dealing with the Myanmar government? And I'm wondering if the Bush administration perhaps bears some responsibility in the situation in Iraq and Afghanistan for a reluctance to unilaterally really go it alone in a place like Myanmar. There's just not the patience or tolerance for another intervention on the part of the U.S. military.
Well, I don't think that's it so much. You know, President Bush 41 intervened unilaterally in Somalia in November of 1992 because of the chaos there to try and open up lines of delivery for humanitarian supplies. He was prepared to get out fairly soon thereafter. The Clinton administration stayed in, and we had the tragedy of 18 Marines killed later in 1993, which I think has turned off the military and a lot of other people to that kind of unilateral intervention. And as I say, while there was a lot of rhetoric about it, I didn't see anybody else stepping up to the plate either.
And 2.5 million Burmese are just going to have to wait. The reluctance of the UN, the reluctance of the power, it just seems like there's no scenario going forward here.
Well, ask yourself this. What about the government of India? It's right next door. It's a bordering country. What did they do? What did the countries of the Association of Southeast Asia Nations, Thailand, Indonesia, Singapore, Malaysia, what did they do? Nothing. China, which is Burma's largest patron, also essentially did nothing. And then it got hit by an earthquake. It's now lost perhaps as many as 50,000 people. So one can ask, what about the countries right there in the region, the bordering countries, the neighboring countries? They didn't do anything either.
Question. Mr. Ambassador, very, very, very quickly, just because we're running out of time, what do you think is the best case scenario in your mind that can happen moving forward from this second?
Well, I think if they can begin to get the relief supplies in, and the government of Burma has now said it will accept all international aid workers, hopefully to stabilize the situation so it doesn't get worse. The after effects of the cyclone, loss of clean water, lack of nutrition, spread of disease, those are the things to worry about now, and that requires a fairly urgent distribution of medicine and food and shelter.
John Bolton, former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, thank you for posing those questions. And as we learned this morning, because of meetings of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, the Myanmar government has apparently signaled it will allow representatives of some regional governments in to tour the devastation from the cyclone, although the status of international aid and aid workers is not completely clear at this point.
So a story with many chapters to go, it would seem, at this point. We're going to turn the page completely and move on to the question that we've been asking today, which is, what are the contradictions in your life? What does that mean? We're talking big ones, small ones. And Casey in Brooklyn tells us, I'm a pack rat who loves minimalism. I love stuff. I hate stuff. It's very confusing.
But it's interesting. We had very serious people talk about contradictions in their religious and professional lives. You had the great interview with Purvis Sharma about people who are living the contradictions of being gay in Islam. People live with contradictions all the time. We got a number of responses environmentally that people drive SUVs, but they try to tell their kids to change light bulbs, that sort of thing. And you, Jack, you know, had probably the most serious of all, that you would like to sleep, but you're up doing our show this morning. So that's a big contradiction.
Indeed.
No,
one that
all
we live.
Of those. And speaking of Parvez Sharma, he'll be taking questions today and tomorrow about his film, A Jihad for Love. You'll find a link on our homepage, so check that out.
That'll be really interesting. And, you know, keep your responses coming to thetakeaway.org, mytake at thetakeaway.org, or 1-877-8-MY-TAKE. Last week, we asked for photos of your workplace in celebration, I suppose if you could call it that, of the 40th anniversary of the cubicle. And we got some great pictures, and included our own workspace there. The slideshow is now online with commentary from design critic Debbie Millman, who joined
us. Also online. Oh, sorry, you done?
Go.
Also online, a video of our martini cowboy. Check that out.
Jack Grace. See Jack Grace on our website. It's The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Freeman Foundation, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.